Our guest this week, along with sports maven Len Berman, has served as co-host of the successful morning show on WOR Radio in New York for the past 5 years. The program provides its listeners with a provocative mix of left-right politics and sports, as well as a hefty dose of arts and entertainment. In a previous installment of this podcast, our guest described himself as an Eisenhower Republican. He takes a moderately conservative position in the show's ongoing political banter in counterpoint to Len Berman's liberal opinions, in addition to tapping into his tremendous knowledge of theater. Our guest writes about Broadway for the New York Post, as well as a number of other publications, and is considered to be one of New York's most prominent theater critics. He's also written two best-selling books about Broadway, Singular Sensation and Razzle Dazzle. A graduate of Columbia University, our guest lives in the West Village and is a well-known multi-platform figure in the Big Apple. Stand by for an interesting cell phone conversation about New York City's recovery from the hardships brought upon it by the pandemic, including setbacks to the economy and public safety, the state of Broadway and the theater scene, as well as GOP politics and the future of Trumpism. Our guest this week is Michael Riedel. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Interview, the weekly podcast from Podcast One for media freaks, pop culture aficionados, political junkies, and the philosophically curious. Thank you for downloading this program from Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, the Podcast One app, and Spotify, and for following our Tuesday tweets announcing the names of our weekly guests. To sign up, it's at MH Interview. I can be reached directly via email at michael@talkers.com. If you find this show to be of interest and value, please subscribe to it as well as giving it a positive 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Okay, here we go. An uninterrupted conversation with WOR New York morning show co-host Michael Riedel. It's great to be with you again, Michael. I haven't talked in a while, and I figured with Broadway opening and so many things happening in the realm of politics, you're the guy. So,
thank you, Michael.
First of all, I hope that you're well. I have, as I said, we haven't spoken in about a year. How are you holding up under the conditions of these times?
Well, you know, we barrel through. I managed to get COVID over the Christmas break, and I'd had my third shot, so it was really nothing but a a cold, but it had upended my Christmas plans to see my family. So, but I do think going forward, we're going to have to learn to live with this thing. We don't cancel plans because you have a little cough or a cold. You know, life does go on.
Mm. And that being said, in terms of the broad strokes of day-to-day life, how is life in New York City? There's a new mayor. We're into a new year. What's going on from your perspective in terms of getting back to some type of normal life?
Well, I've noticed in the last week or so, as the numbers of COVID have gone down and this new strain of the virus seems to have faded, and the weather has been not so cold the last few days. At least where I am in the city, in the West Village, it is buzzing. I mean, restaurants are full inside and outside. There's a kind of sense of relief in the air that maybe we're going to get back to a more normal kind of life than we've known in the last 2 years, and I certainly hope so. But I distinctly remember this past summer, everybody thinking we're out of it, ready to go, all my friends on Broadway going back to work, ticket sales were doing very well, restaurants reporting an uptick in the in business, and then all of a sudden you heard these reports, this new strain coming from South Africa. And man, when that hit, it hit New York hard. And that just disrupted everything. So we went into another hole that, God willing, we're just climbing out of now.
And what about in terms of street crime and public safety? The last couple of years, it's just been a terrible decline in terms of New York being among those cities where people didn't feel safe on the streets. There's a new mayor who's a former cop. Is there any progress on that front?
He certainly talks a good game, but we have yet to see what he's going to be doing. And, you know, crime is definitely a problem in the city, but where it really hurts New York City, people should not get the idea that the whole city's falling totally apart. This is not 1972 or 1973 by any stretch of the imagination. But what's terrible for New York City and its businesses is that the perception is out there among people who don't live in the city that it's become a dangerous place.
Yes.
And that they factor in when they decide whether or not, do we want to take that trip to New York or do we want to go to Orlando? And as long as that perception is out there, that is going to pull down the city to some extent. Now, I think Eric Adams was elected. The number one reason he was elected was because he said he was going to get a handle on crime. Because under de Blasio, I mean, de Blasio was just the worst mayor in the history of this city, I think. And his attitude towards crime was, it's all the pandemic. Once we're out of the pandemic, it's going to be fine. That's not the case. I can speak personally. I happened to catch train. I went out to Long Island not too long ago, and I was at Port Authority here, Madison Square Garden area. Mm-hmm. And I was appalled at how that place has deteriorated. I mean, just not only homeless people and, you know, but for the sake of God, go we, and you want to help those people, but people higher than kites on all kinds of stuff. I mean, just people urinating, defecating, falling down, talking to themselves. And then I got on the subway platform, and there was this nice woman standing next to me, and she said, please don't leave me. And I looked around, and there were like five or six guys just walking up on the platform, talking to themselves, and these are the kind of people, and you read this in the paper, who they could snap and suddenly push you in front of the train, which has happened here in the city.
Hmm. So what did you do?
You have to get a handle on these mental health issues.
What did you
do? I don't know what the city is doing then.
What did you do in that case? It's fascinating. I'm just thinking, if a woman came up to me on a platform and said, please don't leave me, that's a tough spot to be in, isn't it?
I said, well, let's just go back up against the wall. Let's get away from the platform. And, you know, just talk to me and don't make eye contact. And right. When I say don't make eye contact, these people were walking back and forth.
Oh, geez.
And, you know, if you make eye contact with some of them, then you can be in real trouble. I said, so just talk to me. And then we got on the train and there were three more of these unfortunate souls on the train as well. So I have not seen it that bad since the 80s when I was here in New York.
Hmm. All right. You mentioned Broadway, and I love talking Broadway with you. Before we even get into it, are you still writing a column about Broadway, or are you just a guy that knows Broadway at this point? Because I follow you as a news talk host with Len Berman on WOR, and I don't live in New York anymore. So what's your official connection with Broadway at this point? And then I want to ask you some questions about it.
Well, let's see. I had for over 20 years, I had a weekly column in the New York Post, and that was furloughed when Broadway shut down. Mm. Now I think I'm going back on kind of articles I want to write for them, not necessarily a column, but longer pieces. And I'm writing for Vanity Fair now. I did a 5,000 word piece on Hugh Jackman and the Music Man that ran in. It's out this month actually. And I'm writing for the Wall Street Journal. So at this point, I am kind of the go-to Broadway guy for a lot of people, but I do like writing longer pieces. As you know, I wrote two books, Razzle Dazzle and Singular Sensation.
Yep.
And when you have a little more room and you can write maybe a little more complicated piece, it's sometimes hard to go back just to hacking out a 650-word column that's got a little bit of gossip in it. At this point in my life, I'd rather take some time and write longer pieces about interesting topics or interesting people I know in the theater.
Well, I know that you saw The Music Man and you wrote a piece about it. I haven't read those pieces yet. I will. But I did read the piece in the New York Post that was devastating. I mean, it pointed out a few good things here and there. But basically, it said that Jackman missed the mark. And it presented some questions about whether The Music Man is, in fact, a viable Broadway product today because of the changing, cultural environment in which we're in. What was your impression, for the people listening who haven't read any of these things, of The Music Man on Broadway?
Well, I raised some of these issues in the Vanity Fair piece because there had been some criticism of The Music Man being, just about the whitest show on the planet at a time when there's a big push for diversity. But those questions are handled. The cast is diverse. There are African Americans in the cast. And even though historically, probably not the way River City was, wherever Meredith Wilson was from, probably not that way growing up in 1912. Broadway audiences accept diversity in a cast now, and I don't think no one will bat an eye about it. It's not an issue at all. Now, where the critics had an issue with the show is it is definitely an old-fashioned show. I have great fondness for some of the old-time Broadway shows. I think, you know, you can still get a lot of pleasure out of Hello, Dolly! And The Music Man and MAME and some of those shows. But a lot of the critics who are now more interested in shows like Dear Evan Hansen, Hadestown, Jagged Little Pill, some shows that, for lack of a better word, might seem more complex and sophisticated, a lot of the critics thought The Music Man is just a little too hokey and old-fashioned. Now, it's not going to have any problem in the box office department because it's got about a $50 million advance based on Hugh Jackman's name alone. And while the critics, and the Post was not the only one, by the way, that thought Hugh had missed the mark, the New York Times felt that way too, and there was a particularly harsh review, I thought, from my friend Peter Marks in the Washington Post about the whole thing. But audiences, they're not going to read those people. The audience is going to go see The Music Man in the coming months. And if you love Hugh Jackman, he is delivering a great, fun Hugh Jackman performance. And I think, well, snobby critics can turn their noses up at it. I think people who, you know, paid for their tickets will have a good time with Hugh Jackman. My only issue was I did think the show could have benefited from some cutting and a faster pace. It was a little sluggish. But you are getting the Hugh Jackman show. That's what you're getting. And we know, you know, there's a big market for the Hugh Jackman show.
Yeah, no doubt. And the fact that he is doing it is fascinating because he is such a draw. I've always thought that The Music Man, that one of its major assets in terms of being a cultural piece, an icon in American theater, frankly, was the performance by Robert Preston. It was almost made exclusively for him. As a matter of fact, I think Meredith Willson wouldn't allow them to make the movie unless they did it with Preston. And I was
as well.
Go ahead.
That's true. But Robert Preston was not their first choice on Broadway. They wanted much bigger stars. I think they were trying to get Kirk Douglas at some point to play it. Robert Preston was a B movie Western actor.
Mm.
So he was not on the list when they were doing the Broadway show, but he came in and he gave a great audition and they thought, we can't see anybody better than this. But you have to remember, you know, the Music Man, which was extraordinarily successful in 1957, it took Meredith Willson almost 8 years to get it going. And the only reason he wrote it was because he had an audition. He was a radio personality. And he had auditioned to host a television game show. And he came in for the audition, and it was all set up as if they were really going to broadcast the game show live. They had real contestants. And they handed him his note cards with the questions on it, but he was so nervous, instead of reading the questions, he read the answers. So that was the end of him as a game show host. So he and his wife went back to California, and she said, well, why don't you work on that that musical you want to write about your childhood that your friend Frank Lesser always thinks you should write. And he wrote it, and as people say it's corny today, even back in the 50s,
mm-hmm.
he auditioned for so many potential backers and producers, and the thing he got back, old-fashioned, corny, unsophisticated.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he auditioned it for Moss Hart, who didn't even say a word to him when the audition was over, just put his coat on and left.
Oh, my gosh.
And the next morning, one of the producers of the show called him, and he's just out of curiosity, what did Moss Hart think? And the guy said, oh, he thinks it sucks. Anyway, we're going to move on for another director.
one of the great shows. You know, it's amazing. As far as Robert Preston's concerned, I do remember I was a very, very young child, but I was following theater and Broadway and movies. I loved it. I was surprised to see this guy that you never really thought of as a brilliant musical comedy star playing that part. And that was so much a part of what it was about. But the movie, I like, it's one of those things, I every 2 years or 3 years, I go back to my vaults in my childhood, and I pull out things that I want to see again and see how I feel about them. And musicals are like that. And I recently watched The Music Man, and I have to tell you, that second act, I was wishing it were over already. You know, like, there was no need to have four songs by the Buffalo Bills. They could have combined them into one little 3-minute piece, and it would have been great. Four songs by the Buffalo Bills, a barbershop quartet, as good as they were. It's like, who the hell could put up with that? And
I always found the Shapoopy to be a little extraneous.
Yes, it was like a show. It was like this long you know, piece from an old TV variety show for the specific person of giving Buddy Hackett a reason to have a song. Very ponderous and old. What was your impression of the revival? The last Broadway musical that I saw in person was the revival of Carousel. I'm sure you saw that.
Yeah, that one missed the mark, I felt. Mm. It's quite a brilliant show, a very sophisticated show, really Rodgers and Hammerstein at their best. But to be honest with you, I don't remember that much about it. But I just remember being underwhelmed because in my mind, the great revival I saw years ago at Lincoln Center, directed by Nicholas Heitner, the British director, and making a star of one, Audra McDonald, and that was a carousel for the ages.
Yes.
And this one just fell short of that. There was a very fine production of The Music Man in 2000, directed by Susan Stroman and starring the late and much missed Rebecca Luker, who died sadly of a disease that took her too young from us last year. And she was just lovely as Marion the Librarian. Craig Bierko was Harold Hill, and he was, to my memory, he was pretty good. Hmm. Sutton Foster is very good in this production, although she's not a soprano. And those songs made famous originally, as you know, by Barbara Cook, they had to lower them for Sutton's range. And while she's a fine actress and a fine singer, those songs feel to me that they need to be up there a little higher in the sky.
How interesting. How interesting.
Marion, the librarian, is this, you know, she's this tough, cynical, she doesn't trust anyone. But underneath that exterior is this light heart that is just longing for someone. Mm-hmm. And I think that comes out when she sings those soprano songs like Till There Was You, The Bells in the Air, My White Night. That's when she reveals the real heart of who she is.
I understand that Till There Was You and 76 Trombones is the same song, the same melody.
It is. Yeah, that's good. Now, that's a brilliant stroke on the part of Meredith Wilson. It's a very good score, much more sophisticated score, perhaps, than the show is, because it has essentially the first rap song.
Yes.
It doesn't know the territory, which has no music. There's no music to that song. It's all done vocally.
Yeah, yeah,
and,
that, it's amazing.
And you almost don't realize that 76 Trombones and Till There Was You are the same song, because, you know, for Harold Hill, they're rousing, and for her, it's a ballad. And then when they come together at the end, he puts the two together and you think, ah, of course. Didn't realize that.
Very clever. Very Beatles-esque in a way. Of course, it's preceded the Beatles. I just want to ask you one more show question, then I just want to get a little into politics, and I'll let you run.
Sure.
Another one of those iconic movie musicals that came from Broadway where it was a big hit was West Side Story. And I have to tell you, for all of its perhaps political incorrectness, I am a devout fan of the movie, the original movie with Natalie Wood. And
it's great.
You know, to me, it was perfect. I recently saw an updated production of West Side Story at a regional theater in Florida that I'm a big fan of, where it's just about as good as Broadway productions. You know, could be on Broadway. And I went to see their version of it, and I came away angry because they modernized it. They put in a couple of scenes about the hurricane in Puerto Rico. They updated it. They presented it today. And frankly, you know, the Jets came across to me as a bunch of Nazi skinheads, and the Sharks came across as a bunch of soft-hearted, you know, gentle guys. It was completely anti-Jets. And frankly, Maria and Tony didn't seem to have that spark of love between them. It was more of a lust. It was like they just couldn't wait to get into bed with each other. How did Spielberg do with the West Side Story? I know you saw it.
I did. I thought he did a very fine job. I mean, it was his sure hand as a director, and he did not fall into that trap. He did not make the Jets these horrible people and the Sharks these wonderful immigrants. You know, he understood both sides. He understood that they're fighting over this territory that they're all going to lose anyway, because what Tony Kushner and Steven Spielberg brought to it was the gentrification that was going on the west side of New York. Because remember, they were going to clear out all of those tenement buildings, all of those neighborhoods to build Lincoln Center.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a poignancy in seeing these two gangs beating each other up and killing each other in some cases in the show. And you think, guys, in a year, you're going to be swept away. It's going to be Lincoln Center for the rich people who want to go to the opera. You're done. You're fighting over that. Nothing you're going to even have your hands on anymore.
Amazing.
So that added some poignancy. And I'll tell you, the best part of the movie for me was still that Bernstein Stevens Sondheim Gore score, performed, I think, by the Los Angeles Philharmonic under the direction of Dudamel. Mm-hmm. And it was just beautiful. It was so operatic, lilting. These lyrics, of course, still hold up. And those just gorgeous, sophisticated, classical melodies that Bernstein wrote in the hands of Dudamel have never sounded better. And the other thing, I was a little skeptical because Tony Kushner is very, very political. And I thought, you know, I could see him going totally anti-cop in this movie where the cops are a bunch of bad guys. Mm-hmm. He doesn't do that in a sophisticated way. The cops are shown, especially Officer Krupke, played by Brian D'Arcy James, as people, too, who are just trying to get a handle on this gang war that's going on, and they're exhausted by it as well. Mm. And they're doing the best that they can,
right,
which probably is the case, I think, for cops today, as they're trying to get a handle on the crime in New York when their hands are tied on so many levels.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a major issue, obviously, and it's one of the key issues to the crime problem we have in urban centers around America. The thing that I'm pleased to hear is that they kept it a period piece and didn't update it. I think sometimes the tendency to, you know, I'm such a purist about that. I still think James Bond movies should take place during the Cold War and never have come up into the age of terrorism. I mean, it's a legitimate argument, isn't it?
Well, It is. Speaking of the James Bond movie, I finally got around to seeing that last one, which I thought was terrible precisely because he's not fighting the Russians. He's
right.
Just fighting these weird-looking criminals who are getting their hands on nuclear bombs. And I said, where is the humor? Where's the lightness of touch? You know, where's Roger Moore when you need him? Daniel Craig was so brooding in this movie. And, geez, mm-hmm. Not even a joke anywhere.
Yeah, so these are all things that I think have to be weighed when you talk about revivals. And, you know, sometimes the original, even though it may not technologically or politically correctly fit the times, it's still the best. For example, King Kong. I love the movie King Kong. I consider it on my top 10 list. Anytime people ask me, what are your favorite movies of all time? King Kong is in there. And the revivals that have been so many, they're technologically fabulous. I mean, the one with Jack Black was like, wow, what a piece of work. But I couldn't watch it twice. You know, these are all the things about art that I think sometimes get lost as we make this. We're making this huge shift into computer-generated graphics and short attention span. And it really is having an effect on how art is presented. Let's talk about the art of politics. You, every time I talk to you, I'm always delighted that no matter what, and even though you are a conservative, you are not a fence sitter. You seem to be very fair, and you don't seem to be partisan, and you don't seem to give your heart to any one politician. What do you think is going on right now, going forward, with the midterm elections just over the horizon? And mm-hmm. the presidential election just over the next horizon, in terms of GOP politics with Mitch McConnell and Pence, you know, basically breaking ranks with Trump, et cetera. What do you think?
Yeah, I thought that was significant for Mitch McConnell to come out and say that January 6th was a violent insurrection. I think those were his words. And Pence saying, he warned President Trump about this and he was not going to do that. That shows you that, and, you know, especially Mitch McConnell, that guy is as shrewd as they come in Washington. So that tells you, you're getting a sense that just maybe he doesn't think Trump is going to run again, and that Trump's holding power over the Republican Party is beginning to wane. I'm not so sure McConnell would have come out and said what he did if he didn't think that that's what's going on. I think the Republicans are still in a very good position to take back the House and the Senate, and that is largely the Democrats' fault because the Republicans haven't done too much. They haven't presented too many proposals for things. But the Democrats found themselves in this very precarious position where Biden decided to go very, very bold with a very left agenda to suit the progressives. But he should have taken into account the power of Manchin and Sinema. Those people come from red states. They cannot be seen going into the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez category, because if they do, they are going to lose their seats. And Biden, you know, what's the old line? You never put it for a vote unless you know you've got the votes. And when Biden wants to compromise with people like Manchin, and okay, say we can whack it down a bit, maybe we should break it off, I know you don't like this, the progressives lost their mind, and they were not supporting Biden. So Biden suddenly found himself in a position of allegedly the most powerful man on the planet, having no power in Washington to get his package and his agenda through. And now it seems to be stalled out, and they're going to have to break it up, but it's going to take time. And it shows, it contributes to the perception out there that I think of Americans have, that this is a weak president, this is a weak presidency. And he's not been helped by Kamala Harris, because she's deeply unpopular. Mm. So I think the Democrats have some real trouble on their hand going forward. Now, my gut tells me that Trump is not going to run for the White House again. You know, he is older. He has more energy than Biden, but he is older. And I don't think he wants to put himself through the grind of the primaries, but he wants to be the kingmaker. So he wants you to go down to Mar-a-Lago and kiss the ring, and he'll give you his blessing. I mean, my money right now would be on DeSantis. I think he gets some points for doing the best he could against COVID, but without shutting down the Florida economy. I think when we look back on this, places like New York, the more blue states where, you know, people like Cuomo shut everything down. At first, I think people thought, okay, that's fine. But that shutdown went on and on. And then when people begin to lose their jobs and their restaurants go out of business, people think there must have been another way to find a proper balance between trying to keep us healthy but not causing all of the problems that you do when you completely shut down an economy. I mean, I know, you know, my friends on Broadway, they had no income for a year and a half. No income, nothing, you know. And you can imagine the other people in the other businesses that were shut down that had no income. And I thought DeSantis, I was down in Florida last winter, and I thought it seemed pretty good. Okay, wear your mask here and there, but you can still go about restaurants. You can still live your life to some extent. Now, that's partly because of the weather. But I think DeSantis gets points for not taking over the economy and closing it down and acting, frankly, like an emperor, as the unmissed Andrew Cuomo did when the pandemic hit.
Yeah, it's funny how things turned out for them. Do you think that it's possible, between those two, do you think it's possible that McConnell is breaking ranks with Trump, not because he thinks that Trump's not going to run, but because he thinks Trump will run, and he's trying to steer the party more in a direction that it has a chance to win in 24, maybe even in 22, so that people like DeSantis can move to the front of the pack comfortably without Trump muddying up the water, or maybe running and losing to the Democrats? You know, a year and a half is a long way off.
Well, I mean, we predict at our peril, but I still think if Trump decides to run, he's going to be very tough to beat. He has a core solid base, something like 30-35%. And someone like DeSantis, who, let's face it, you know, is not really that known across America yet, right? You know, those of us who follow politics know him. Trump just comes out there so strong that I think anybody else is going to have a tough time gaining on him. Now, can he win in the general election? Well, he won one, but he lost another one.
Yeah, well, that's the question.
So we don't know where we are. And it's going to depend, of course, on who runs against him. I personally don't see how Biden can go another 4 years. I don't see it.
No, I don't see Biden. I don't see Harris replacing Biden. I can't see either of them. But
no.
There's always Hillary Clinton.
I think if you put Trump up against Hillary Clinton, he can still beat her. If you put Trump up against Elizabeth Warren, he can beat her.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who's on the Democratic side that really could pose a big threat to Trump as I see it right now.
And there you have it. An uninterrupted conversation with Michael Riedel, morning show co-host at WOR New York, author and theater critic. Thank you for downloading this program from Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and the Podcast One app, and for following our Tuesday tweets announcing the names of our weekly guests. To sign up, it's at MH Interview. I can be reached directly via email at michael@talkers.com. If you find this show to be of interest and value, please subscribe to it as well as giving it a positive 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you're interested in hearing my weekly 1-hour radio show, The Michael Harrison Wrap, check out mhwrap.com. Our producer is Matthew B. Harrison, The Michael Harrison Interview. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Interview is a production of Good Phone Communications presented in association with Podcast One and Talkers Magazine. Copyright 2022, all rights reserved.